Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a faith healer declares himself a prophet and inspires his followers to starve themselves. And is Philip Glass's music a model for a more open-minded world? But first, the seven states that depend on water from the Colorado River Basin, Arizona, California, Nevada, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, recently gathered in Las Vegas. The summit came amidst uncertainty about the future of federal funding for water-related projects that each state depends on, and a looming 2026 deadline to resolve a range of thorny disputes. Joining us to break this all down is KUNC's Alex Hager, who was in Las Vegas for the summit. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Alex, prior to this conference, you did this great piece where you compared the seven states to siblings fighting over a dwindling family fortune at a holiday meal. And listening to your reporting from the conference, I came away with the impression that there was a lot of grandstanding where representatives from the seven states were sort of competing for who could issue the most stern call for collaboration. Is that a fair characterization?
I think that's completely fair. There was a lot of bluster, but relatively little substance. The states kind of all got up on stage and talked about the negotiations without actually making any progress in them. Worth noting here also, you know, in recent years, those seven states have all appeared on one panel together. This year, they were split into their two camps, so they did not all have to be on stage at once. I think that really underscores the tenor of these meetings, that they are deeply divided. And, you know, for what it's worth, we know that they're not going to make much progress in negotiations up on stage in front of a crowd. But historically, there has also been, you know, a series of important meetings that goes on outside of the main conference programming. Those states meet behind closed doors while we're all in Vegas together. And from everything I understand, those states did not do that this year.
Well, that's not encouraging. what are the main points of disagreement?
Well, really, this breaks down to the fact that there is more demand than supply for the Colorado River's water, and someone is going to have to cut back, probably many someones. But exactly who and by exactly how much is the major point of contention. There is going to have to be sacrifice here. There are 40 million people in cities like Phoenix and Los Angeles and Denver, and a giant agriculture industry, including a pretty large sector of that in western Arizona, that depend on this water. And realistically, one of those groups, or many of those groups, are going to have to make some changes to how they use water if this entire basin is going to want to use less. And that might be uncomfortable. It might be expensive. So the states are kind of playing a game of chicken to see, you know, who offers to give up more water or enough water first.
In your reporting on this, you also spoke to a U of A professor named Andrew Curley, who's also a member of the Navajo Nation, and he told you that the native tribes who are stakeholders here have been invited to the table, in his words, 100 years too late. How has their presence in these negotiations complicated all of this?
Well, there are 30 native tribes that have land within the Colorado River Basin, and they historically have been shut out of meetings about how to manage water in this region. But because they have very old rights, they have very protected access to water. Technically, you know, they control about a quarter of the river's flow, although a lot of them don't have the money or the resources to put it to use. So they would like to have, you know, more say in those meetings, because they do ultimately have, you know, legal control over a lot of the river's water. But to the states, that is a little bit of an inconvenience, because now, instead of just having seven individual groups with different needs, you now have 37 groups with individual different
right.
needs. And so for the states, the strategy historically has been to kind of ignore them. That is why they are calling for greater inclusion now. It does seem that there has been some progress made to bring those native tribes further into the fold. But ultimately, if you ask representatives from those tribes, a lot of times they say they need to be brought even further into those conversations.
Sure. Well, So here we are with these 37 different stakeholders all declaring the importance of finding a solution here. Have representatives from any of these groups come forward with any sort of meaningful proposal for what a new agreement should look like?
So the states are divided into two camps, the lower basin of Arizona, California, and Nevada, and then the upper basin of Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico. Each of them has a separate proposal. The lower basins does involve some sacrifice, but the upper basin says that's simply not enough. The upper basin says it should not have to give up water at all. The contention made by those mountainous states is basically that, you know, we have to make a consistent delivery. We have to send water down from our big reservoir to your big reservoir every year, and it has to be more or less the same amount of water. But the upper basin states contend that we don't receive the same amount of water on the front end every year because climate change means that, you know, those mountain states are beholden to the ebb and flow of how much snow falls in any given year, and they want permission to send less water down. The lower basin says that is a non-starter. The lower basin says, we're going to all have to make cuts and we have to make them more evenly, and they just kind of are not willing to play ball with the upper basin's plan.
So as if this weren't complicated enough already, you've also reported that the imminent return of Donald Trump to the White House is looming over these negotiations. How is he expected to impact all of this?
Well, if you ask the people in charge, especially at the state level, they'll say, look, we don't expect that a Donald Trump presidency or another Donald Trump presidency will affect the negotiations too much, because there's a longstanding historical precedent of this being an issue left to technical experts, Republican or Democrat. The people who actually pull the levers at our biggest dams and reservoirs, historically, they are people who know their stuff and are a little bit shielded from the political winds of Washington. They expect that to be the case again. There is no telling whether this, you know, unprecedented president, president-elect, is going to actually respect some of that historical precedent. But even if he does, there is the bigger question of federal funding. So a lot of the efforts that have been made over the past 4 years to kind of balance out the problems at our reservoirs, to stave off catastrophe at Lake Powell and Lake Mead and at the Hoover Dam and Glen Canyon Dam, has been aided by a lot of money from the federal government. The Inflation Reduction Act, the Biden administration's signature infrastructure spending plan, it set aside $4 billion just for Colorado River work. And through that, the government has helped save a lot of water. It's paid farmers to pause growing on their fields and add a little bit of extra water into those low reservoirs. It has paid cities to make efficiency upgrades to their city water systems. And all of that might go away. The Trump administration, or, you know, President-elect Trump on the campaign trail, has promised to claw back unspent money from the Inflation Reduction Act. And so a lot of the peace and space and time that the negotiators have had to have these disagreements and to take their time working through negotiations has been afforded by the big spending plan's ability to buy them time by saving water here and there. And that might not be the reality in the future.
Well, one of the many issues with a lot of uncertainty surrounding it as we approach the new administration, that is KUNC's Alex Hager keeping us in the loop. Alex, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
The preacher William Branham died in Tucson in 1965, but millions of people around the world still follow his teachings to this day as part of a religious sect known as The Message, thanks in part to the more than 1,000 recordings of Branham that still exist today.
Now, I'm just your brother by the grace of God, but when the angel of the Lord moves down, it becomes then a voice of God to you. Maybe if I offended you by saying that, forgive me. But I felt that might have been resented. But I am God's voice to you. See, I say that again. That time was under inspiration, see. And I felt bad about the first time, but it repeated it. Now, see, I can say nothing in myself, but what he shows me, I say it. You believe it, and watch what happens.
The recordings of these often hours-long sermons are distributed around the world today by a company called Voice of God Recordings, which is run by the late preacher's son. And the sects he has inspired, including here in Arizona, have been called cults that have sometimes turned destructive. Tim Steller, with the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson, spent a year investigating the message, and my co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him more about it.
Well, I knew nothing about this except that in late 22, I got an email that was sent to several journalists, a bunch of journalists in Arizona, by someone local here in Tucson who was trying to stir up interest in his investigation into the church he used to belong to here in Tucson. I arranged a meeting with this man and several of his confederates, and we're sitting there talking at this table, and they keep making reference to this name Branham. And I finally had to stop them and said, wait, who is this Branham you keep talking about? And they said, well, this is our prophet. And I was like, oh, you know, I had no idea about this. So that's when I realized this one church was part of a much bigger world that had this man, William Branham, at the center of it.
Wow. Okay. So let's talk about that. And I want to have you kind of explain this religion by painting a scene for us that you paint in the story. When you kind of walk into a South Phoenix church called the Jericho Tabernacle Church, and people are in the church like it looks normal, but then a recording starts to play instead of a preacher getting up and talking. And it's from a sermon from William Branham from, you know, decades ago.
Right. This is something that churches do around the country. So this was a very windy night in January in South Phoenix. I went to this church because I'd heard of it and asked if I could attend. I'd identified myself as a journalist, and they said yes. There's hardly anybody in the church that night. But the amazing thing was to be sitting in the church with the people listening to this crackling recording coming on, hearing the sounds of this busier church service coming on in Jeffersonville, Indiana, 50 to 60 years before. And the interaction between people in a church today with people in a church 60 years ago, responding to what was going on there.
Okay. So the teachings of William Branham, his sermons, are distributed, it turns out, around the world, not just in churches like the one here in South Phoenix. And it's part of this religion called the message, right? So tell us about what that means and how far it seems to have spread in your reporting.
So the message is what William Branham's ministry turned into in the 1960s. He had been a faith healer of great renown across the United States in the 40s to the 50s. And gradually he developed this kind of ideology or these ideas of his own that were referred to as the message of the hour or the message. Mm-hmm. And he also had the great sense to have people recording his sermons starting in 1947, I believe. So today there are more than 1,200 sermons recorded. So there's this organization called Voice of God Recordings. It is the organization that dedicates itself to distributing and housing Branham's sermons. It's named Voice of God Recordings because Branham had once said in a sermon about his own gifts, "I am God's voice to you." So they have all these recordings, and over time, they've developed the way they distribute them so that now all the recordings are available online. Mm-hmm. You can download an app called The Table. You can do a keyword search. Look up, for example, Sabino Canyon down here in Tucson. He had some supernatural experiences there. So I several times had to look up Sabino Canyon and pulled up sermons from the 60s where he talked about it. And also Voice of God Recordings sends out tablets around the world to different places where people view William Branham as their prophet.
As their prophet, right. Okay, so this has been called a cult, and there have been some really dark stories that have come out of some sects of this. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so our reporting concluded that one of the downsides, the big downsides of this ministry is that it delegates all the power in a church, in a congregation, to the pastor. That is, the pastor is considered somewhat infallible in many of these churches. And also because they're end times churches that focus on the coming of the end times, there's a tendency for the pastors to become very powerful. and in some cases become cults. So for example, we mentioned the Shakahola massacre, which occurred in Kenya in 2023. Hundreds of people starved themselves to death. The pastor, Paul McKenzie, was influenced by William Branham, certainly. This goes back to Chile in the 60s to 90s. Mm-hmm. In Colonia Dignidad, a German man formed this German colony in Chile, which was rigidly fenced off. And in Arizona, perhaps the most troubling example of this was what's known as the Park. It was a commune established by two of William Branham's closest associates. He let them spin off their own congregation, or really a commune, at a mobile home park in Prescott, which became the site of just awful mistreatment and abuse of children, as well as adults, sexual abuse, physical abuse, terrible lashings. And this went on for around a decade, from the 60s into the 70s, and is really only now being exposed by some of the Arizona residents who lived through it as children.
Wow, wow. So all of this kind of connected back to this preacher. Talk a little bit about what the company has said now. His son runs a Voice of God recordings company that you mentioned that distributes his father's recordings. What did they say about some of the awful examples in which this has really gone wrong?
Well, in general, they say that these are not examples of the message, that they're perversions of what William Branham wanted. For example, the people in Kenya starved themselves to death, whereas William Branham, they say, said, if you're fasting, when you get hungry, it's time to end the fast. So they say these people just took some of the things that he talked about into crazy directions. I should mention Joseph Branham, who is the surviving son you mentioned. He is, I think you could call him a sometime resident of Tucson, mm-hmm. and is viewed by some people around the world as the new prophet.
Wow. Okay. Let me ask you lastly, Tim, about just what struck you most about this as you're reporting this for a year or more here. I mean, the tentacles of this go far and wide, but there's so much here in Arizona as well. What stands out to you?
I guess what really jumps out at me is just the fact that there are these subcultures that are hidden but existing. For example, you know, Tucson Tabernacle, a church I've driven by dozens, if not hundreds of times. I didn't know that it began life in the 60s as the first William Branham message church in Tucson.
Right.
But it's sitting there with the phrase "only believe," which is one of Branham's key phrases, painted on the side, and it never struck me, you know, after 27 years of living here. But, you know, another thing is just that people are, this is not news, but people are desperate for meaning, for answers to the big questions. And, you know, if they can't find them one place, they'll find them another place. And sometimes it's not a healthy place. So they will follow people who give them answers or give them a feeling of leadership. And that's certainly what happened in many of these subsects of the message.
Yeah. All right. That is Tim Steller, reporter for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson, joining us to talk more about this 7-part investigation on the message. Tim, thanks for your reporting here. Thanks for talking about it.
Sure. Thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we visit one of the best escape rooms in the world, according to the Top Escape Rooms Project.
I like to think of escape room as like escaping reality, not escaping the actual room. And
ooh.
So anything that really leans into that is something that really stands out to me.
We will hear what keeps escape room enthusiasts coming back for more. But first, there is a big change coming for members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And it has to do with what they wear under their clothes. Now, this is not underwear, exactly. Mormons who are faithful wear what are called temple garments underneath their clothes as a reminder of sacred covenants. And now, LDS women around the world are cheering because they will soon be able to wear these garments without sleeves. It's hard to overstate how welcome this news is for many Mormon women. And it could point to an attempt by church leadership to get more young people to actually wear the garments. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke more about it all with Jana Reese, a senior columnist for Religion News Service, who covers the LDS community.
Temple garments are things that Latter-day Saints receive when they go through the LDS temple for the first time for themselves. Essentially, that means that you go through a ritual called an endowment, and before that, you are washed and anointed to prepare for the endowment. And as part of that experience, you receive new undergarments called temple garments. Mm-hmm. And from then on, you are supposed to wear those temple garments underneath your street clothes. So just on a regular day, every day, you will have those on underneath whatever people can see as your regular clothing.
What's the significance? Is obviously it's supposed to be, there's supposed to be a religious significance here, but does it also have to do with maintaining modesty?
Well, officially, in the ceremony itself, the idea is that these are a symbol of the clothing that God gave to Adam and Eve when they left the garden. You asked about modesty, and certainly as people have tried to understand it and connect it to daily life, modesty has come up, mm-hmm. particularly for women, and that can be a really thorny issue for some women because it does sometimes feel like, for some women, that the garment has not necessarily reflected their needs, their medical needs, their social needs, their needs for clothing that is that feels good and looks good. And so over the years, there have been some complaints about the garments, both quiet and increasingly loud with social media.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about this most recent change, which sounds like a big one. And especially for women, as you say, tell us a little bit about what the announcement of this coming change to the temple garments says and what it will look like for people.
So in October, the church first presidency made an announcement that changes would be forthcoming to the garment, particularly for members who live in hot climates, such as the Philippines or Africa or possibly islands in the Caribbean. It will be almost a year from now that any of these new styles will be available to members in the United States. So, you know, the initial cheering that greeted the announcement was followed, I think, in this country by some disappointment that it was going to take so long for members here to receive that. One of the things that has been trumpeted and greeted with a lot of enthusiasm is the addition of a sleeveless garment for women.
Yes.
So initially in the 19th century, garments went all the way to the wrist and all the way to the ankle. And then in the early 20th century, it was authorized to have them come to the elbow and down just below the knee. And so over the decades, we've seen changes to adapt to clothing styles. And this is kind of in that, I mean, you can sort of think of early church leaders possibly turning in their grave at the idea of a sleeveless garment for women.
So there's a level of like, this is about ease and comfortability for particularly women in hot climates. But there's also a level of style here, right? Like, as you said, like changing these garments to reflect the style of the day.
Yeah. I mean, certainly younger women have complained that the garments with cap sleeves, or for men, even short sleeves, that they are not essentially reflecting the times in which we live. And it's sometimes difficult for people to find clothing styles that they think are fashionable and that they like, but that will be compatible with garments. So that's kind of an ongoing push and pull.
Yeah. So what has the church leadership had to say about this, Janet? Like, do we know why they kind of finally made this move, which is something that a lot of LDS women, it sounds like, thought would literally never happen?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. They have not revealed the behind-the-scenes discussions that perhaps led to these changes. Over the course of the last year or so, it's clear from some of the comments that they have made that there is some concern on the part of church leaders that people may not be wearing their garments as often as church leaders want them to wear their garments. And there's been, I mentioned push-pull, there's been a bit of a relaxation and then a crackdown on wearing of garments. You know, I also research Latter-day Saints, and my research partner, Benjamin Knoll, and I, we surveyed in 2022 and 2023 Latter-day Saints and former Latter-day Saints in the United States. And we did actually ask them about garment compliance. One of the findings was that although there have been some rumblings from church leadership that perhaps women in particular might not be compliant with garment wearing, that they're going to stay in their yoga pants all day long. And we actually found that women were a little bit better at garment compliance than men, but that it was all young people that were essentially not as compliant.
There's this big generational gap that you uncovered here. Is there speculation, Jana, that this move from the church could be an effort to sort of make this a little more palatable to younger people so that they will be more willing to abide by this tenet, to follow these rules?
I think yes and no. I mean, the yes part is some of the things that we have heard more regionally in Utah and elsewhere of general authorities speaking about garments and some of their concerns, particularly about younger people and women wearing garments. Mm. But on the other hand, you know, recall that this new policy is being rolled out abroad first. At least on the surface, it is not being affected or galvanized by what's happening in the United States. But if I could add another on the other hand, because this is what researchers do, right? On the other hand, Africa has been hot for a while now, right? And this is, it's great that this is happening, but that doesn't explain why it's happening now.
So let me ask you, do you think this will encourage those young people who have sort of fallen by the wayside here in terms of wearing their garments to wear it again? Do you think that this will make it a little bit easier for them?
I think only time will tell. You know, in conjunction with our survey research, I've also interviewed more than 100 current and former members of the church in the United States.
Right.
And I would say that based on those interviews, it's not just a matter of making a garment fit better or making it more palatable. Those are terrific things. But there is a larger and more systemic question of bodily autonomy, which is something that generationally is a lot more important to people now than it would have been 100 years ago,
right,
or 150 years ago, that you have the right to decide who touches your body. You have the right to decide what you wear on your body and who gets to tell you what to wear on your body. And that larger question, I think, is not going to be addressed by just shortening a sleeve length by an inch. You know, that is something that is a bigger discussion.
Do you think that that discussion will start here or continue here because of these changes?
I'm not particularly optimistic that church leaders are very interested in those conversations. You know, I think they view garment wearing as a really vital expression of what it means to be a Latter-day Saint, not just for this life when you're concerned about clothing for this life, but for eternity. And when you cast it in those parameters, that changes the game.
Yeah.
I feel like people are talking past each other a little bit.
Sounds like it. Okay, we will leave it there for now. Jana Rees is a senior columnist for Religion News Service joining us. She covers the LDS community, researches it obviously as well. Jana, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for explaining this. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Music has long been associated with altered states of consciousness. Now, when I say that, I'm guessing an artist that comes to mind for many of you might be, say, the Grateful Dead or Pink Floyd. But have you ever considered the mind-expanding power of classical music? Well, the OpenScore Ensemble invites you to do just that. The group performs interpretive renditions of works by composers in the minimalist tradition. Minimalism often features repeating musical phrases performed in extended loops on instruments which aren't often combined in traditional classical music. Think electric organs, saxophones, and improvisational chanting. Lately, the OpenScore Ensemble has been rehearsing a series of works by the famed minimalist Philip Glass, music with changing parts and excerpts from Einstein on the Beach, Glass's legendary five-hour opera. The OpenScore Ensemble will perform selections from both of these pieces next week at Crescent Ballroom, and I am joined now by two of the group's members, organist and vocalist Paula Tesoriero, along with fellow organist and director Jacob Adler. Jacob, let's start with you. How would you describe the Open Score Ensemble?
So the Open Score Ensemble is a constellation of very talented musicians that revolves every year in every project. And it started off originally as an improvisation ensemble where we would take musical parameters and record a wide variety of improvisations. And then there was shifted more toward performing creative arrangements of 20th century classical music.
Gotcha.
Composers like Olivier Messiaen, Giorgi Ligeti, Steve Reich, Julius Eastman, Philip Glass.
Paula, what appealed to you about this way of playing music?
So as I was exiting high school, I was also kind of leaving behind the classical piano lessons that I'd been taking for most of my life. And I had a few friends who were in Jacob's improv ensemble, and that just seemed like a really sort of free way to explore what the idea of improvisation and approaching music from not just like the written form. One thing that I really appreciate about Jacob's leadership is that I don't feel pressure. So I don't feel like something should be a certain way, which is something I definitely have encountered, especially as a female musician. And that's not something I've ever encountered in a space of yours, Jacob.
Oh, it's good to hear.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Can I ask what prompted that pivot at the end of high school, that move away from the more, it sounds like, traditional
mm-hmm.
form of playing that you had been doing?
Yeah. I think that there was a transition for me kind of like halfway through high school where everything was just difficult. And one of those difficult things ended up becoming my relationship with the piano. And I felt very much like it was for other people. Like it had shifted from I like playing the piano to like my parents have this expectation of me, or people just call me like the piano player. And that's sort of my identity.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So how was the experience of coming into the Open Score Ensemble and having what sounds like a much greater degree of freedom?
It just feels very much like I am a part of this bigger thing, and I couldn't do it without all these people around me. And my role is significant, but it is significant because I am a part of something.
Yeah. Jacob, can you tell me a little bit, as the director of this ensemble, how did you move from this kind of completely blank improvisational canvas into bringing the values of improvisation to your interpretations of these composed works?
Yeah, that's a good question. After a few semesters of exploring the improvisational ensemble, I just simply had a desire to kind of shift to composed pieces, but because the ensemble would have a different instrumentation each semester. Music by a lot of minimalist composers like Philip Glass, I thought those scores lend themselves very well.
And is that because in these more minimalist compositions, the music is kind of more defined by musical phrases as discrete elements rather than like the capacity of the instrument? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think music with Changing Parts by Philip Glass, which was composed in 1970, is a great example. When you look at the score, it is for an open score, but it was originally written for his own ensemble, which consisted of woodwinds, voices, and electric organs. So there's a very distinct sound world that he created with his ensemble. But when you look at the score, you can see that the different lines of music, the musical patterns, are not scored for specific instruments, and the ensemble has freedom to pick and choose which patterns they want to play. So you see these this constant stream of eighth notes, these different cells of eighth notes, which are repeated ad infinitum until we decide to move to the next one. Those can be exchanged and alternated freely by the musicians.
And I will also say something I really appreciate about this music is it does require patience. So it requires patience for me, the performer, and it requires patience for the listener. And in a world that's moving ever more quickly, it's nice to be asked by something that, you know, will only exist for a certain amount of time to exist alongside it.
That's beautiful. Knowing much less about Philip Glass than either of you, I have this sense that in performing it as a musician, it could become quite trance-like.
Absolutely. It's kind of like saying your name over and over again. It starts to lose all meaning and becomes a sound. But it does allow me to hear things, what you might call psychoacoustic phenomena, where you hear all of these different sounds that are floating in the room, and you start hearing things that might not be there. You might start hearing phantom musicians, voices that you or bells or percussion or winds or strings which might not be in the room. And sometimes minimalism has that effect.
That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Paula, what about for you? What is your experience with the trance-like nature of this performance?
Not so much a trance-like state for me, but what I do engage with is, like, as I'm performing, can I almost, like, take a step back from what my hands are doing and breathe and kind of, like, relax different parts of my body? Or can I step back from what my hands are doing and, like, look at somebody else for a moment? It's almost like I have space to, like time slows down in a certain way for a part of me, where this other part of me is like, I trust my body. I'm trusting my body completely so that I can, like, focus on other parts of my body to settle into or to just have awareness of the present moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. So, like, Jacob, you were talking about psychoacoustic phenomena. You're talking about almost more of like a physical phenomenology that the music enables that, if I'm hearing you right, is not necessarily available in other styles of performance.
Yeah, like when I'm playing like an original piece of my own, the it goes so quickly. It's there and then it's gone. And this music gives me more opportunity to kind of slow down and be present with what I'm doing, what I'm hearing, the people around me. Just having this very like open approach, I think, to music versus closed-mindedness.
Yeah. Wow. You know, this is my favorite thing that happens in musical conversations is all of a sudden I feel like, are we even talking about like music anymore? Like we're sort of talking about how do you build a community with the capacity to inspire and invent something that's greater than the sum of its parts. It sounds like Philip Glass maybe points the way to that a little bit. Well, Jacob and Paula will be performing on December 19th at Crescent Ballroom right here in Phoenix. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. For some, the holiday season is the ultimate escape. If you don't feel that way, you might be interested in a different way of departing reality. Earlier this year, I met some Valley residents who specialize in providing just that.
Okay, I definitely don't know how to get in.
It's a Wednesday afternoon, and I'm walking around Desert Ridge looking for the entrance to a place called the Nemesis Club. I've been given an address, but it leads me to an ice cream shop called the Soda Jerk. I walk into the Soda Jerk and I find happy families enjoying sundaes and root beer floats. I approach the counter, where one of the employees is standing in front of a large refrigerator door.
Hello. How's it going? I'm
looking for the entrance to the Nemesis Club.
You found it.
I did.
You okay. Did, yeah.
Cleverly disguised as a refrigerator door.
That's right.
She opens the refrigerator door and leads me into a series of dark wood-paneled hallways lit by low lamplight. Finally, we arrive in the lobby of the Nemesis Club, where a small group is waiting for us.
Three of our eight players, so we've got a little bit of time.
Okay, hello, three of the eight players. I'm Sam.
Hey,
thank you guys so much for doing this.
Of course.
This is in the name of journalism.
The task we're about to undertake in the name of journalism is an escape room, one of three operated by the Nemesis Club. The one we're about to do is called Mogollon Monster, and it's one of the top 100 escape rooms in the entire world, according to Terpica.
Terpica stands for the Top Escape Rooms Project Enthusiast Choice Awards.
That's Rich Bragg, the founder of Terpica. If anyone has played enough escape rooms to qualify as an escape room enthusiast, it's Rich.
I'm at about 1,300 overall now.
Some escape rooms, Rich says, are just a set of walls, a handful of themed puzzles, and a timer. But the best rooms, the ones that appear on Terpica's Top 100, those are much more immersive. They have full-blown sets, sound design, and actors playing characters. For Rich, these are the elements that put the escape in escape room.
I like to think of escape room as like escaping reality, not escaping the actual room. And so anything that really leans into that is something that really stands out to me.
Back at the Nemesis Club, I meet the players I'll be observing as they make their way through the room, the Ford family. It's a group of brothers and sisters who look to be in their late 20s or early 30s, along with their parents and some friends. The Fords may not quite be at Rich Bragg's level, but this isn't their first rodeo. How many escape rooms would you say you've played?
Gosh, what do you think?
Hi, I'm Victor. I'm one of the friends. We've done probably upward of 20 to 30 together, and then just on our own also. We're all, I think, very seasoned.
This will be my third one. Just this week.
Oh my God, you're on a streak.
We are on a streak. We're on an escape room streak.
With the group fully assembled, a Nemesis Club employee in a ranger uniform approaches us.
My name is Emma. I'm going to be your camp counselor today. We are heading up to the Mogollon Rim to a campsite built by the Monster Rangers. That's an organization that studies monsters.
Emma reaches towards what looks like a painting on the wall, but turns out to be another secret door.
Oh my God.
She opens it, and we file into a tent full of camping gear.
Scoot over.
All right, so rangers at this particular campsite study the Mogollon monster. That's kind of like Arizona's Bigfoot, yeah?
Emma explains our task, which is to capture evidence of the Mogollon monster on camera without making it angry.
I know it's a weird phenomenon, but the storm does tend to follow the monster as he walks through the woods. So if he's super close by, you might get like a left.
Everybody huddles in the dark as the sound of heavy footsteps and beastly grunts gets closer and closer. After a few moments, there's a clap of thunder and a burst of lightning, and a giant monster silhouette appears against the front of the tent. The shadow lumbers away, and Emma says, we're on our own now. The tent opens, and the Fords make their way into the darkness.
And we need the lanterns. We need to take them.
Here you go, Mama.
Okay, I'll take the lantern.
When I asked Rich Bragg, the founder of Terpica, to describe some of his favorite escape room moments, he hesitated.
The ones that I'm thinking of right now are ones that if I told you, the owners would be really mad, so...
Rich's words are echoing in my mind as I watch the Fords start to explore the makeshift campground. I realize I'm standing in the middle of a mystery that the Nemesis Club has gone to great lengths to immerse me in. So while I can assure you that the Fords had a great time...
So there's like a little secret door and there's bacon, so I'm wondering if he will like...
There it is, got it.
Woo!
Woo!
There
what
it is.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4.
It just wouldn't feel right to give you any other details about what happens in there. Besides, the specifics of this particular escape room aren't the real mystery. For me, the bigger question is personified by Emma, the Nemesis Club employee who plays the role of the camp counselor. After we finish going through the room, Emma tells me that she just got back from vacation, and while she was gone, she used her free time to check out some other escape rooms.
I have to say, it's notable to me that you spend your work week in an escape room, and then in your free time, you go to escape. Like
yeah.
When you're on vacation from the escape
room,
you go... Say that again?
It's like a lifestyle, yeah.
So, if escape rooms are about escaping reality, what happens when escaping becomes reality? That, it turns out, is another situation that Rich Bragg has a lot of experience with.
So I actually came from a community of puzzle games called The Game, which don't really exist anymore, but it was kind of an underground community. There was not a lot of, it wasn't really mainstream at all.
The Game, Rich explains, is a reference to a movie called Midnight Madness, which came out in 1980.
Five diametrically opposed teams of college students are challenged to compete in a grueling all-night game. Midnight Madness.
Midnight Madness tells the story of a grad student named Leon who designs this all-night puzzle game. The players are told to show up at a random location where they get a mysterious clue. If they can figure out what the clue means, it leads them to a new location where they get another clue.
The game will begin Friday at sunset and continue on through the night until one team is the first to arrive at a final location, the finish line.
So at some point, someone decided to make a real-life version of the game from Midnight Madness, and that's the game. Rich started playing it when he was a student at Stanford. I asked him how it worked, and he says one time he got a message that just said, show up at this train station.
And we were told to get on the train, and it's funny because we didn't actually know where the train was going until we were on it, and it took us like 100 miles away or something.
When the players got off the train, there were vans waiting for them, which took them to a field where each team was given a custom-built wand with LED lights and sensors.
It would sense the sort of swishes and flicks that you were doing, and if you had solved a puzzle and you then translated it into the wand language and you did all the right things, then the wand would know that you had solved that puzzle, and then the LEDs would light up and you could shake the wand and the LEDs would spell like what you had to do next. So
jaw is on the floor.
Yeah.
This rules.
It was amazing. Yeah.
The problem with the game is that playing it was a huge commitment. You had to block out an entire weekend for it, and you didn't know where it was going to take you.
It didn't scale well.
Sure, yeah.
Ever since escape rooms have become super popular, that whole subculture has just kind of died out.
Towards the end of my afternoon at the Nemesis Club, I meet Kylie and Dustin, the co-owners.
The last question I wanted to ask is, so when I was talking to Rich from Terpica, he brought up this thing called The Game.
I know The Game. Okay, but go ahead.
Oh, you know The Game.
Go ahead. We've never been invited to play The Game, but we've had brushes with The Game.
Really? What are the brushes?
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it. We had a couple groups come through, and by the way they were talking, we could tell that they were connected to the game, and somehow our venue had been connected with the game for some period of time. But honestly, I don't know a lot more than that.
Really?
Really? No, really. Do you?
So far, you're saying everything that I know about
it.
But it's intriguing.
It is intriguing.
Okay.
So what happens when escape becomes reality? Maybe they both get more interesting. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman. Special thanks to the Ford family, Danielle, Cameron, Bruce, Lori, and Tiffany, their friends Victor Garcia and Kaylee Woodson, and Kylie, Dustin, Emma, and everybody at the Nemesis Club. All right, well, from river basins to religious garments, from secret entrances to psychoacoustic phenomena, a somewhat thaumaturgical Thursday here on the show. Thank you for spending your morning with us. We will be right back here at 9 a.m. tomorrow. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you then.